Thanks, Ivan. The goal is to keep our remarks relatively short, 10 minutes. So I'm going to, while speaking to you, also try and keep one eye on my watch. Because I know, actually, the best part of all of this is not listening to us talk at you, but you all asking us questions so that we can answer them and really dive into the issues. I always have to do this every time I get up and speak. I need to do a standard disclaimer because, as Ivan said, I am with a senior fellow with the Independent Institute. As my think tank affiliation, I do have a day job. I am not standing here in front of you representing my day job because some of my clients include parts of the United States government, and I'm not speaking on behalf of the United States government or my employer. I'm here today as a senior fellow with the Independent Institute. Let me also start off, and I think it's fair to say I'll speak for all of us, on none of us are arguing that proliferation is a good thing or that Iran or North Korea should have nuclear weapons. I mean, you need to understand that starting off, because I think some of the remarks, certainly you'll hear from me, probably from Doug, probably from Trita, might be misinterpreted if taken out of context. So I think it's vitally important that people understand that I'm not standing up here in front of you today saying, yeah, it's okay for Iran and North Korea to have nuclear weapons, and I want to encourage, you know, the development of those two countries acquiring nuclear weapons. In fact, I think we should be taking every reasonable effort to try and dissuade those countries from acquiring that capability. In the case of North Korea, giving up their ambitions. But, and what my paper is all about, is that given the reality of the world that we live in, for better or worse, we may have to accept the fact that either or both of those countries, and perhaps others, are going to eventually acquire nuclear weapons for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is a current U.S. policy of regime change. In fact, a policy that while the Bush administration clearly has decided to act forcefully upon it, is not just germane to the Bush administration. The Clinton administration is just as guilty of military intervention to depose leaders that the United States government or leaders in the United States government didn't like and didn't think should be running a country. So if you put yourself in the shoes of people like the regime in Tehran, like the regime in Pyongyang, and look out at the world, and you see the way the United States acts, it's easy to understand. I'm not endorsing their actions, but it's easy to understand why they would want to pursue a nuclear weapons capability as a way to prevent the United States from engaging in military regime change. So that's part of it. There are a whole host of other reasons, and I know Doug and Trita will get into more details as to why countries would want nuclear weapons for reasons other than preventing and deterring the United States. But let me throw out a couple of things as food for thought, and then we can hopefully in the Q&A get into some of these issues a little deeper. One thing that I think is vitally important, particularly when we talk about Iran, is that the conventional wisdom, certainly the wisdom portrayed by the Bush administration and its rationale for conducting what it called preemptive war, what I characterize in my paper as preventive war against Iraq, is this notion that if regimes like Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq, the mullahs in Tehran, acquire nuclear weapons, they're going to give them to terrorists, that terrorists will have easy access to the ultimate weapon. And, of course, you know, that's why President Bush and others in the administration have from time to time conjured up the image of a mushroom cloud going up in a major U.S. city. And that is, you know, quite honestly, certainly post 9/11, the biggest fear, that terrorists might acquire a nuclear weapon and detonate it in an American city. Let me start with this. I said this in Berlin last week when I was with Doug at a conference. As terrible as that would be, I mean, I think, you know, as an analyst, and that's what I'm trained as an analyst, we have to understand that a nuke going off in an American city, as terrible and as tragic and as unwanted, certainly, as that would be, it's not the end of the world. It really isn't. The end of the world is when the Soviet Union could rain down thousands of warheads, just as Russia still can today, by the way, if they wanted to, on the United States and obliterate us as a country. That's the end of the world. A single nuke, small-yield nuke in particular, going off in a major metropolitan area, resulting in possibly hundreds of thousands of deaths. Catastrophic, yes, certainly order of magnitudes larger than 9/11, but not the end of the world as we know it. We could recover from such an event. In fact, during the Cold War, we had plans for recovering from thousands of Soviet warheads landing on the United States. So there's a certain perspective that we have to have, that as much as we don't want that catastrophic event to happen, that we do have to understand that it really wouldn't be the end of the world, end of the world. There are other worse things that would be much more catastrophic that could occur on U.S. soil. So that's one going in thought. The other thought is this, is that while it's popular to paint this picture that regimes like the mullahs in Tehran would give a nuclear weapon away, I think there's another side to that story that doesn't get told. One is there's no history of any of these regimes, so-called rogue state regimes, who have acquired so-called weapons of mass destruction capability. And we lump chemical and biological weapons in with nukes and call them weapons of mass destruction, even though a nuke really is the only sort of massively destructive weapon, at least by single detonation. Biological weapons, particularly contagious pathogens, can cause lots and lots of deaths over time, but not instantaneously. And chemical weapons are really, really nasty, but hardly massive in scale. Yet they all get lumped together as weapons of mass destruction. We know that at one time Saddam Hussein actually did have chemical and biological weapons. We know that he used them against hapless Kurdish villagers in his ongoing war against Iran. But here's the other thing we know. Despite the fact that Saddam did support terrorist groups, he never gave those groups chemical or biological weapons. In fact, there's no history of any regime that has acquired chemical or biological weapons, let alone nuclear weapons, giving away those kinds of weapons to terrorist groups that they support. They may be more than willing to finance them. They may be more than willing to give them, you know, conventional explosive and other types of weaponry, small arms, but they seem very reluctant to give away, you know, what we have now called weapons of mass destruction. So you have to ask yourself, okay, you know, we say, you know, that they would give these weapons away, but there's no history of it. Now, why do we say that? Well, part of it is, I think, is because we're ignorant in the sense of misunderstanding, particularly the Muslim world. We assume Saddam Hussein, you know, is from the Middle East and at least sort of Muslim in some way, shape, or form, that therefore he's in league with the terrorists, or the mullahs are in league with Hezbollah. Therefore, you know, they're the same, and Hezbollah is simply an arm of the regime in Tehran. So, of course, the mullahs would give these weapons to Hezbollah to attack the infidel enemy, the great Satan, as Ayatollah Khomeini once characterized the United States. But the part of the story that we don't talk about so much is the fact that groups like Hezbollah or Hamas and other terrorist groups that are affiliated with regimes largely in the Middle East is that they're not controlled by these regimes. There's a reason they're non-state actors. They are not part of the state. They have overlapping interests, and they may both have a great hatred for the United States, or at least an animosity towards the United States. But these groups are not 100% controlled by the regime in power. In fact, in Iraq, Saddam, to the extent that he supported terrorist groups, kept them on a pretty short leash. I mean, he understood that in some respects they were potentially a threat to him as much as they might hate a common enemy, whether it's Israel or the United States. So if you're a regime, and it's this amazing phenomenon that when you come to power, you sort of want to stay in power. I mean, that's true for American politicians. It's true for, you know, it's true for leaders everywhere around the world. So the odds that they will engage in what amounts to suicidal behavior, either meaning if they had a nuke, launching it at the United States, knowing that we could retaliate with the full force of our strategic arsenal. I mean, deterrence kind of works. At least nuclear deterrence seems to work. And I think we tend to discount the power of our nuclear deterrent. I think we could still reduce the number of weapons we have in our arsenal and be very secure, and that's a debate for another day. But the point is that against other nuclear-armed countries, deterrence seems to work and certainly served us well during the Cold War, worked against the Soviet Union, and seems to be working against China. And unless we believe the regimes in North Korea, Iran, and other places are actually suicidal, that they would just launch a weapon willy-nilly knowing that they would be destroyed as a result of doing that, I think deterrence would continue to work even in the undesirable situation where North Korea and Iran eventually acquire nuclear weapons. If the regime gave away a weapon to terrorists and the terrorists actually used it, the short list of who we, the United States, would consider guilty is really short. It's not like, although some people might want to point to the French, it's not like we're going to look to the French or the British and say, you gave away a nuke, to terrorists and they detonated it in New York. We're going to be looking at the regimes in Iran and North Korea and other such places. And these leaders know that. And they know what the consequences are likely to be. In fact, there's an irony. If one of the reasons that they're acquiring nuclear weapons in the first place is to prevent regime change, the last thing you want to do is give a nuclear weapon away to a group that you don't control who can then take an action that would result in the United States doing exactly what you're trying to prevent in the first place, which is regime change. The other thing is that if you gave a nuclear weapon away to a group like Hezbollah, what are the odds that Hezbollah would say, hey, this is a great way we could take over the country, not our country here, but Iran? I mean, you've given away the ultimate weapon to a non-state actor that you don't control, and suddenly they're tempted with the possibility of, hey, we can run the country, where they're not running the country now. They're simply, one group with some overlapping interests. And in fact, I think that's one of the reasons why Saddam kept the terrorist groups that he did support on relatively short leash. These groups, given enough power and the ability to do certain things, become just as much a threat to the regime that gives it to them as they would with the United States. So since I've used up almost all of my 10 minutes, those are just some food for thought. And we can get into discussion. The paper that I've written talks about this in a lot more detail. But the bottom line is that, again, not that we want North Korea or Iran to be nuclear powers, but they may be, and there may be nothing we can do short of what Ivan said, deciding to invade more countries, take them over and run them, which we're not doing such a great job of at the moment, and for which we don't have a tremendous amount of capacity to do. We may have to accept that they become nuclear powers, and so our non-proliferation efforts have to then start focusing on what do we do then, including working with regimes that we might have hostile relationships with, but where we have common concerns, say, over safety and security of weapons. By the way, the North Koreans and the Iranians don't have a history of understanding safety and security of these weapons. Are there ways that we might actually, maybe it has to take place, completely below sea level, in other words, not in the public eye, are there ways that we might work with these regimes? Just as, during the Cold War, we were adversaries with the Soviet Union, but we maintained embassies in each other's countries. We had a hotline between the two capitals. We communicated with each other, and I think there's a lesson to be learned that even with countries that are our adversaries, such as or have hostile intentions, that we still have to talk to them, which is something that we're not doing so well either with North Korea or Iran. And we may have to look for ways of cooperative effort, even if it's cooperative effort that's not seen in the public light, where they might be open to some possibility of finding ways to make these things safer, knowing that it's in their interests to do so. And we need to start thinking about these things now is really the point of my paper, that even though we don't want Iran or North Korea to get nuclear weapons, if all we do is focus on keeping them from getting weapons, then we're unprepared for when we fail. And we have to accept that we might fail in that goal of preventing them from having nuclear weapons. So what's plan B? If plan A is to prevent them from getting weapons, but that doesn't work out so well, what's plan B? Is the only plan B to invade them and take over? Or are there other plan Bs that we can look at? And let me very quickly just sort of leave with this last note. Of all the countries we should be paying attention to, it's not North Korea, it's not Iran, it's Pakistan. Pakistan is sitting on top of nukes. the Musharraf regime is in a relatively fragile position, you know, at least tacitly an ally in the war on terrorism. But Pervez Musharraf will not be around forever. There have been several attempts on his life. What are we going to do if a more radical Islamic regime takes over Pakistan and is sitting on top of live nukes? I don't have access to all the privileged information, but I hope we are exploring all sorts of creative possibilities with Pakistan. One that I mentioned in my paper is that we give the Pakistanis technology and training to do render safe of their weapons so that the regime, if they thought there was about to be an imminent coup, could possibly render safe all the weapons so they couldn't be used. Sort of that's one thing to do. The other is, which is, again, not a very popular thing or not one that I'm saying should be our first choice, but I also hope that the military has an off-the-shelf plan to take out Pakistan's nuclear weaponry if that's the only option left at our disposal. And one thing that would certainly help is if the Musharraf regime would engage in some unprecedented cooperation to help us understand where those weapons might be so that we could target them in the event that the regime fell into the hands of radical Islamists. But of all the countries I think we really need to worry about, it's less North Korea, less Iran, and much more so Pakistan. And it's unfortunately a country we have not been quite so focused on. Thank you.